This was supposed to be the secret teachings. Now they can't be secret anymore. Anyway, I've only just started. When Ajahn Chah used to talk about Samatha Vipassana, calm and insight, he would hold up his hand because he didn't have any other visual aids to help him. So he would use whatever he had to try and explain by a symbol what these concepts really mean. And he would hold up his hand like this and say, "Now you can see the front of my hand." But, he insisted, the back of the hand was there as well. Only you just couldn't see it. It was just right behind. "Now you can see the back of the hand. You couldn't see the front. But the front is there." And he said, that's just like Samatha Vipassana, Samatha Vipassana. One might be in front, but the other one is right behind, even if you can't see it. So when you are doing calm practices, insight will be right behind. And if you're doing insight, calm is right behind. You cannot separate them at all. So said the great master Ajahn Chah. And what he meant by that in practice, if you really are becoming calm and still and peaceful, then insights start to arise. That is one of the signs that you are getting peaceful. The wisdom arises. And how does that work? Number one, as I've been telling from the beginning of this retreat, when you have calm, peace and stillness, your mindfulness increases. You literally see more. Or, as I mentioned in that simile earlier on, about walking up the hill to Bodhinyana Monastery, looking through the window of a car, you hardly saw much at all. But I thought I knew that hillside. And when I got out of the car and started walking, I saw more. When I stood perfectly still, only then did I see everything. And you can understand how to get insight. You do really need stillness. Otherwise, you're just going too fast to see what's really there. You don't have enough time. Now, this is another exercise of, here we go, I'm going to use this. Sometimes I pick up this thing, but I'm going to use this. Now, this is an exercise on what insight is. What is this I'm holding up? Koala? What else? Soft toy? What else? Tell me what else you can tell me about this. What else? Come on, I want some insight. What else? Furry animal, yeah. What else? What else? What else? Can you understand the longer you look, the more you see? And if you just say koala bear and finish with it, there's so much you miss out. This is one of the problems. Many people think insight is thinking. You give it a name, koala bear, and you think that's all that is. It's much more than that. So to get insight, you have to take an object, be still with it, until you finish with all of the names. Because all the names is what you've been told it is. And if you're going to get insight, you have to go way beyond your knowledge of what you've been told it is to see it what it truly is. And all the thoughts have vanished. And I remember reading a story. Now this was in Harvard University, maybe about 100 years ago, when there was a famous professor was advertising for a research assistant. And so this young man, who eventually became the professor's research assistant and wrote a biography about him, told how he was examined to see whether he was competent to do research for this famous scientist. When he turned up at the lab, the scientist took a bottle down from the shelf. And there was a preserved fish. He put the fish on the table and said, "What's this?" He says, "The fish, keep on looking. And when you stop seeing things, then let me know." And so this student, he looked at the fish and says, "The fish," and then he gave it its names. But then after a while, when he exhausted all its names, he started to seeing things he'd never been told before about the fish. When it came to lunchtime, the professor said, "Are you finished yet?" And he said, "Surprisingly not. I'm continuing to see more things. Go for lunch and come back in the afternoon." He came back in the afternoon, late in the afternoon or in the evening, still hadn't finished. "I'll go home, come back tomorrow." And this research student spent 2 days just looking at the fish, always seeing new and more things. And the professor said, "Well done, you've passed your test, I can use you." But if you're going to do, say, research in science, you've got to see things which other people haven't seen. You've got to go beyond knowledge to see the truth. This is one of my sayings. Never allow your knowledge to stand in the way of truth. The knowledge says this is a teddy bear. What else is it? Meta. Or whatever else it is. You can see so much more in things. Now, this is the problem where most people practice so-called insight. They just keep thinking. More names. Just the same old things you've heard from other people. Now, we get something like metta, compassion. How many of you understand what compassion is? Hardly any of you. You think you do. You can spell compassion. You can translate it into Hokkien, into Mandarin, into Bahasa. But do you know what it really is? It's much more than a word. So I was telling people, just instead of having words, have exercises so you can actually find out, you can feel what compassion is. And holding teddy bear is one of those. Hold it. And after a while, you can feel compassion, kindness. That's insight meditation. It's no longer a word. It's something you can feel. It's an emotion, not a signpost. And the even better way of understanding what compassion is, I described, but maybe you didn't get it, the very first teachings on meditation, how to relax your body. Very simple, and you think, oh, that's just preparation for real meditation. You really want to get into it. Relaxing body, yeah, I can do that at home, but I want nimittas, I want jhanas. No. When you start relaxing your body, you will find whatever it is which relaxes it, which lets go of the tightness, the tension. What was that? That was compassion. That was kindness to your own body. He relaxed it. Now you know what that is, as an experience, as a feeling. Before even the word starts to describe it, you know it as a feeling. And this is one of the most important parts of our meditation. To get to know what compassion, metta, whatever you wish to call it, really is. Not as a word. Because once you know what it is, then it's easy to practice compassion. Why is it we're all supposed to be Buddhists? We're all trying to be kind to one another, but we still argue with one another and complain. Why do we do that? Because we don't really understand what compassion is. It's just a word to us. It's just, this is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness. We all know how to chant it, but not many people know how to do it. So this is where we get insight. We can actually feel it. We can see it in action beyond the words. So whenever you are relaxing your body, what works? What takes a headache and makes it less? What takes a gut ache and just evaporates it. That was kindness. That was compassion. Like I said, when my mother would kiss a wound, straight away, the pain would go away. Why? That was kindness. That was compassion. You could feel it. A mother's love towards her son. You could feel that. It was real. And that's what took the pain away. And so, if you understand what compassion is, and get insight into what that is, by what makes you physically relaxed, takes away pain, and also takes away the pain in the head, or the anger, the striving, the wanting to get rid of things, wanting to attain things is not compassionate. Even, I often say, even how many people describe metta compassion. May all beings be happy and well. That is not compassion. Because there are some people don't want to be happy and well. And it's their right to be miserable. So real compassion is, if you want to be miserable, the door of my heart's open to you. You can be miserable. You don't always have to be happy. And that's just a huge problem when you come on retreats. Or if you're a nun or a monk, you think, I always have to be happy. Because especially in front of lay people, when you go in your room, you can punch the wall and you can swear. But in front of others, you must be happy. You don't have to be. You can be who you are. In other words, the door of our hearts is compassionate for you to be who you are. You have miserable days sometimes. You have happy days sometimes. So real compassion is letting people be, even if they're miserable. And that brings me on to the story which became the title of the Good Path Who Knows book in the United States. Because there was a young lady here, she was Indonesian but living in Australia. I won't tell you her full name, but her first name was Ronnie. So everybody knows her. And on one of these retreats, she came up to me in the interviews, like people do, and said, I'm really fed up. I just don't like this retreat. Because everybody's supposed to be happy, and I'm not happy. I feel miserable. And I said, well, what's wrong with that? He said, well, it's not allowed. Okay, you can eat a bit of noodles in the afternoon, you can talk, you can break this rule and that rule, but that's one rule you're not allowed to break on a retreat, she thought. You have to be happy. He said, I felt miserable, I felt grumpy. And when she mentioned that word grumpy, I had my insight. I went into the office there, there's a computer there, and very, very quickly I opened up Microsoft Word and printed out the first, there's been many since, the first grumpy license. It was on letterheaded paper, Bodhinyana letterhead paper, and it said, grumpy license on the top, in very nice font. And underneath it said, this license grants to the holder, and I put her name, Veronica, permission to be grumpy for any reason or no reason at all, at any time for the rest of her life, signed Ajahn Brahm. And I signed it. So I told her, here you are, you have official permission from me to be grumpy. So you don't have to not be grumpy anymore. You just be grumpy. And you know, as soon as he got the grumpy license, she wasn't grumpy anymore. She was happy. That's psychology. But anyway, afterwards, she could be grumpy whenever she wanted. No problem. That is compassion. So be careful. Sometimes say, may you be happy and well. May your sickness be overcome. That's not being compassionate. Say, if you want your sickness to be overcome, may it be overcome. If you want to stay being sick, it's fine by me. That's compassion. Not controlling people. Not trying to make them fit in to what you think they should be. but loving a person for who they are. That's why the insight which I got from compassion from my father, the title of the first book, Open the Door of Your Heart, which was, no matter who you are, no matter what you do, even if you're the worst meditator who's ever sat on this floor in Jhana Grove, you'd always be welcome next year, the year after, forever. The door of our heart is always open to you. We're not trying to control you. We're not trying to even change you. We're trying to love you for who you are. You don't have to change. That is compassion. If you're sick, you're sick, and I can still be kind to you. If you're crazy, still be kind. If you decide to all convert to Christianity this afternoon, fine, by me. Whatever it is, this is beautiful, opening the door of your heart. That is what compassion really means. But sometimes people argue, say, well, that's not compassion, I'm not good enough, I have to improve. If I just do nothing, or you keep on saying I'll just be as bad as when I started, no improvement at all. We're not here to improve. We're here to be at peace with ourselves. That's meditation. Not to attain things and change things and make yourself into superwoman or superman or super nun, but to make yourself at ease with yourself, at peace. And the story which goes with this, you are now in this beautiful forest. It's a nice sunny day today, so today is a good day for go for walks, if you want to go for a walk. And if you do go for a walk today, I'm going to give you a test. I want you, when you go for a walk, to find the perfect tree in the forest. The one which is dead straight, perfectly straight, going up, with all the branches equally spaced, with all the leaves green, no yellow leaves, no brownies, just green leaves, and all the leaves without any insect bites on them, perfect green leaves, with the bark nice and smooth, which has never been damaged. Go and find me that perfect tree in the forest. If you do find such a tree, you won't be in this forest, you'll be in a government-run plantation. They're plastic trees, they're not real, they're not natural. But you look at these trees in the forest, a natural forest, they are all bent and crooked. They've all got branches broken off them. And those branches, when they break off, they leave holes. And that's where the animals live. They're really important. That's their nests. You find me a tree with only green leaves. They've got yellow leaves and brown leaves. I remember last year going to Nova Scotia in, I think it's October, at the fall season, when I just made it exactly, but to the day, the best time to go and see the changing colour of the leaves. And those forests were gorgeous, they were all gold, a little bit of green left, but a lot of red as well. And it was just so gold, they joked with me, said, Ajahn Brahman, your robes, if you went to walk in the forest, we'll never find you. Perfect camouflage, this is what a forest looked like. But it was gorgeous. So if they're just all greens, it wouldn't be beautiful. And look at the bark on those trees. They've all got damage on those barks. Damage from the storms, the bushfires, the winds of life. And if you go into this forest and you try and find the perfect tree, the one which you like the most, the one which you think is so beautiful, I guarantee you'll be probably the most bent and crooked one. The one which has got all these bumps on the bark, on the trunk. Those are the most beautiful of the trees. So imagine that we came here, how long, 5 or 6 years ago we started this. Imagine that one of the first things we did was straighten up all the trees. make sure they were all perfect for the perfect Jhana Grove Meditation Retreat Center. That'd be crazy. Because the most beautiful trees are the ones which are bent and crooked. The most beautiful human beings are the ones who are bent and crooked and scarred, with bits of them falling off. That's the most beautiful. Now, are you one of those plastic trees? Is that what you're trying to be? Or are you one of those beautiful trees in a forest? Can you take a look at your body and mind and say, the door of my heart is open to me, just as I am. And I don't want to change me one bit. If you can say that, you have some insight into how to find peace. If you want to change yourself, first of all, before you get enlightened, Maitreya and Buddha would have come and gone before you become enlightened. Instead, we make peace with ourselves. Compassion. Open the door of your heart. You get insight into how to meditate. And you know, it's not striving. Striving just wastes time. It's the wisdom power. You meditate year after year after year after year after year, getting nowhere. And one day you get it. You get a bit of wisdom, insight. From that time on, meditation is the easiest thing in the world. There's that moment of insight. Look at the Buddha. 6 years of struggling and striving, getting absolutely nowhere. Just one evening, became a Buddha. That's how close people are. When you asked last night, can we become stream winners, once returners, non-returners, arahats? You can become this morning an arahat, if you can see it, and just press that letting go button and stop trying to change yourself. And just be. Let go of all craving. We want to change ourselves first, make ourselves perfect, and then we get let go of craving. No way. So, we have the insight into how to meditate. And I mention this just in passing. It's great my bring it up now because it fits in perfectly here. Mindfulness. Huge thing. And sometimes people have all these definitions of mindfulness, mostly coming from psychologists. And psychologists, they know about the mind, but they're not very clear on what compassion and kindness is, to be quite honest. And so I always like to add that kindness, and that's really important. You can't separate mindfulness from kindness, otherwise it just doesn't work. So when people ask me, well, Ajahn Brahm, you've been a monk for such a long time, mindfulness started from Buddhism, so what is mindfulness? Give me a definition which is not just for the examinations, not theory, but which you can put into practice, which works. And that's where I usually quote, not from the Buddhist sutras, but from Leo Tolstoy, and his Emperor's Three Questions. And I recall reading this story at Cambridge. It was a book of short stories by Russian novelists. And I remember one of the other ones was Anton Chekhov. But this was from Leo Tolstoy, a very short story. I don't know where he got this, but when I read it, wow, that was one thing which important to change my life. And it was the Emperor's Three Questions. The story was, there was an emperor who was upset with all religions. They're always fighting amongst each other. You know, the Christians saying we're the best, and which part of Christianity is the best? The Muslims, the Hindus, even the Buddhists. Which is the best Buddhism? Mahayana, Vajrayana, Theravada, Hinayana, Mahayana. Which is the best? Always argue with one another. Crikey, I mean, is this what religion is supposed to be doing? Just more arguments? So he was so fed up with all the religions, he decided he was an emperor, he could make his own religion. Start from scratch. So he started contemplating and discussing with wise people and professors and religious leaders. And after a lot of thinking and contemplating, he decided, You don't need religion. All you really need is the answer to three questions. And if you have the answer for these three questions, you have all the religion you need, and you have a practical guide for your life. And it became the Emperor's Three Questions. And many of you know these because I often talk about it because it's such a powerful teaching. When is the most important time? Obviously now. When is the most important time? Right now. It's the only time you have. So if you want to meditate, meditate now. When's the only time you can get enlightened? Now. Not in the next retreat. Not this afternoon. Yeah, you know, I'm going to have a rest this morning. I'll pull off enlightenment until this afternoon. Now is the most important time. And the next one was, you know, that was an easy answer. I expected that one. But who is the most important person? And when I read that, I thought, you know, because I was a Westerner myself, I was the most important person. That was the wrong answer. And so if you're religion, is the Buddha the most important person? No. Your parents? No. Teddy bear? No. Who is the most important person? And the answer was just brilliant. The one right in front of you right now is the most important person. So you're the most important person in the world for me, now, honestly. But not anymore, now Carol is. Now that was mindfulness. The one right in front of you is the most important person in the world for you. And if you practice that, it changes your life. In people keep saying, okay, meditation, Buddhism, business, the fake world. Look, that makes the fake world real and successful. If you're in business and your client is right in front of you, they are the most important person in the world. Give them that importance and they will know that you care for them and you are paying attention to them. You can listen to them. You get the message. You can understand what they want, what they need. And your customer keeps coming back again. Your supplier, the people you work with in the office. How many people in your office, when you talk to them, aren't listening? Or when they talk to you, you don't listen. Why? Because it's not important. It changes the whole experience. If the one right in front of you, you regard them as the most important in the whole world. I try to do that. Honestly, when you come in for your interviews, and you're right in front of me, you're the only person in the world. That's why I try and connect with you. Listen, give you absolutely full attention. Because you're important. That is being mindful. And I'm going to go back to that again in a minute. And the most important thing to do, people keep asking, what am I supposed to do? It's a beautiful answer as well, to care. It's not doing something or changing people, but caring. And I often quote here the story of the doctor, the Sri Lankan young man. He grew up with in our temple in town. And when he first year as a doctor, he came to see me in a temple in Nolamara wanting to resign, change his job. He couldn't do his job any longer, he said. After all those years of studying, passing his exams, now he was practicing as a doctor and he wanted to give up. Why? Because his first patient had died. Tragic case. A young woman. And he had to tell her husband that the woman he loved more than anything else in the whole world had died. And his two young children had no more mother. He said that hurt him so much to have to say that. He said, I can't do that ever again. And he said, I feel guilty. I let the whole family down. And of course, he had done nothing wrong. He tried his best, but people die in hospitals. That's what happens. But it's a waste of time me trying to convince him of that. Instead, I told him, you've misunderstood the purpose of being a doctor. Your goal of being a doctor is not to cure people of their diseases. That's not your job. Your job is to care for people. That's all. Because if you think your job is to cure them of their diseases, you're going to fail many, many times in your career. There's some diseases, some sicknesses which will not be healed. And you feel you've let them down. But if you realize your main job is to care, you never ever have to fail. You can always care for people. And if a person does die, they and their family know they've been cared for. That makes all the difference. And also, I said, if you make caring more important than curing, many more of your patients will get better. You know that, the power of compassion. Sometimes we forget that in hospitals, curing people instead of caring for them. We forget that in meditation retreats. We're trying to cure ourselves of all our bad habits and defilements instead of trying to care for ourselves. Care for yourself. Don't try and cure yourself. And if you care, caring becomes the main thing. Cure comes automatically afterwards. So those became the Emperor's three questions. The most important thing to do is to say, did you ask a question? Okay. Your hand went up there. The most important thing, the most important time is now. The person right in front of you is the most important. The most important thing to do is to care. And I use that for my meditation practice. So, now is the most important time, when you've got your eyes closed or you're walking meditation. And you say, well, what should I be aware of? Be aware of the most important object. The one that is right in front of you right now. If you're sleepy, that is the most important object in the world. The most important. You're not trying to get rid of it to get nimittas and jhanas or trying to get your breath. No, whatever it is, right in front of you, that is the most important meditation object in the whole world. What is there right now? Straight away, you are now mindful. If you're, say, watching the breath, but you want to see the nimitta, you're not really mindful of the breath. You just want to imagine a nimitta somewhere in the future. You're not really here. You're not mindful. You're not paying attention. You're trying to get rid of this stupid breath to get something better. Just like I remember when I was a student, you go up to these lecturers and ask them a question. And they weren't listening, they were trying to get rid of me, trying to get rid of this stupid student so they can go back to something more important. That felt disgusting. I really felt upset about that. Same with the things in your mind. Don't try and get rid of the thing happening right now. Give it importance, no matter what it is. And care for it. Even sloth and torpor are here to teach you something. A restless mind. They're teaching you, so it's important. Let it be. Listen, pay attention. And you get lots and lots of insight. If you're trying to get rid of things, all these great opportunities for teachings you're missing out on. So now is the most important time. Whatever is right in front of me right now is the most important. And all I need to do is to care for it. Open the door of my heart to this bent and crooked tree that is my mind. Now you have the insight into how to meditate. Such a simple teaching. And that will take you into jhanas, whoosh, really fast. If you practice like that. Because you're doing nothing. You're caring. Being mindful. Not doing anything. So those are the Emperor's three questions, type of meditation. Just, it works. And the deeper you go in meditation, the more the mindfulness comes up, the more you see, the more you understand, the more insight comes. Because your mindfulness gets incredibly strong. And you see things which most people just cannot see. So, as this happens, lots and lots of great insights. Insights into the normal things of life. Why on earth do you get angry at stuff? You waste the time. See these teddy bears here. These teddy bears haven't got angry since they came into Jhana Grove. Have you? You ever got angry at me? No. And even though you mistreat it sometimes. These teddy bears stayed all night here in the cold. Did they complain? No. So try teddy bear meditation. No complaining, no anger. Always there to be cuddled. And they never ask anything for themselves. Beautiful. These are bodhisattva bears. They're just here for your enlightenment. But when you actually understand these types of compassion, peace, just being not complaining, why do I get angry for? You complain and get angry. Do things change when you get angry at other people? Does it really help anybody? It doesn't change them when you get angry at them, but it certainly does change them when you're kind to them. That changes people, not anger. Anger makes them worse. Kindness makes them far, far better. So you get insight into these things. The reason why we get angry, because everyone else gets angry. We just follow other people just like sheep. There was one monk, he was brought up very close to here on a farm. And he said when he was a young man, he'd help his father on the farm, and he went out to see a very rare phenomena. There were a herd of sheep, maybe about 100 or 150 of them. And he didn't know how this had happened, but they'd formed a circle around a big group of bushes. So they couldn't see the other side of the bushes, but there was a big circle, and of course, they were following one another on an unbroken circle, going round and round and round like sheep do. Sheep always follow the one in front. And the one in front of that, and in front of that, in front of that, was the one behind that sheep. So it was an unbroken circle, going round and round and round, and it would have gone on forever. Just like human beings, always following other people, going round and round and round forever, until he actually managed to find one sheep and pull it out of line. And once the line was broken, then the sheep could go off. And he thought, isn't that like human beings as well? Always following one another, never actually being wise enough to see for ourselves what we need to do. So don't get angry. Instead, be kind. When someone's angry at you, give them loving kindness. Say, the door of my heart is open to your anger. You can be angry. I don't want to change you. Come on, give me more. See how angry you can get. See if you can break your record of being angry. This is what Ajahn Chah used to do. When somebody was angry, they asked him, how can I overcome my anger? And so what he did, he said to them, next time you're angry, really angry, sit down, get a cloth, put it in front of you, and see if you can beat your record for being angry. See if you can beat your personal best. 5 minutes? No, that's nothing. Try 10. I'm going to be angry for 10 minutes. I'm going to be angry for 15 minutes. I'm going to be angry for 20 minutes. And straight away you try that and the anger disappears. Because number one, it's a stupid thing to do. What am I doing this for? I'm a crazy guy. But also it realizes that anger finishes anyway, and it's just after it's finished, it's gone. And when you try to stop it, it gets worse. So I'm just going to be angry, that's all. You let it be. And it soon unwinds. So you get all these insights into just the things which really matter in life. Because you start to see things in different ways. Not just the way everyone else sees them. In English, we call this thinking outside the box. Now, how can you think outside the box if you're always in the box? That's why you come out here, no shopping malls, no food courts, no. You're outside the box here. So when you come to a place like this, you can get perspective. This is the simile of insight which I was talking about in one of those first books. when I was just turned 18. Now, I was a clever guy, so I got my scholarship to Cambridge in, I think, November 1968. And I had 11 months off. No schooling necessary. So I thought, great, get a nice job, save some money and go travelling. So I went to North Africa, first of all. That was really cool. And then I went to the United States, and that wasn't cool at all. Because the United States was just the same as Europe. A few different things, but nothing very much different. But I remember just being in somebody's house and reading a book about Central America. Now that was different. That was jungles, a different culture. It had all these ancient ruins, these pyramids of the ancient Mayan civilization. I thought, wow, this is really awesome to go to one of these pyramids and check it out. Because it had all these ideas of Aztecs. They were the worst part of that civilization. That's where they would take someone's heart out when it was still beating as an offering to their gods. Now, that was very interesting to me. But I was understanding, where did this culture came from? Because it just vanished, and no one knew why. So I decided that's a really neat place to go to instead of hanging out in L.A. or somewhere. So I went hitchhiking through Mexico to Guatemala, and got to Guatemala City and found the way, the only way to get to these ancient ruins in the jungle. There was no buses to go there, no aircraft. The only way was to get this bus to the Caribbean coast, a fishing boat along the coast and up the river, and the back of trucks and anything which moved to get to the center of the jungle. It was a 3-day trip. And really exciting. It was a real adventure. And going up that river, which separated British Honduras or Belize from Guatemala, that was one of the old rainforest rivers. And it was just really primitive. And even I remember seeing these natives coming in a dugout canoe, perfectly naked, no clothes. Any moment I expected Tarzan to come swinging out of the jungles. That's what it was like. And when I finally got to this site where these ancient pyramids were, there was no one there. And these days you'd have shops and you have to buy tickets and have fences all around. This was 1969, and I could go anywhere. And of course, I saw one of these huge, and they're really big, these pyramids. And I thought, I'm going to climb up one. Now, why do you climb up a pyramid? It's called a boy thing. If you're a male and you see something, you have to climb to the top of it. Girls are much more sensible. But, boys, that's what we have to do. Don't know why. It's in our genes somewhere. So anyway, not knowing what I was doing, climbed all the way to the top, which is a long way. And I never understood what these pyramids were there for. I hadn't read any guidebook. I hadn't done any research. I just went up the top to have a look. And maybe it was because I hadn't done any research. You got the powerful insight of what these pyramids were there for. For 3 days, I've been traveling in the jungle. And the paths in the jungle, the very narrow paths, they always get covered with tree branches and vines. The forest, the rainforest, is so alive. You cut a path through the jungle and it gets covered up within days. So I was going through tunnels. And I never saw the sky except through the little gaps through the leaves of the canopy above. And even on the river, it was a wide river, but the trees were overhanging the river. You never saw the sky. You never saw a horizon. And after just 3 days of that, climbing up the pyramid, the top of the pyramid was just above the tree line. So when I got to the top, for the first time in 3 days, you could see the sky and the horizon. Infinity in all directions, with nothing between me and the infinite. Wow. Now I understood what those pyramids were there for. To give you a very amazing insight into the nature of truth. Emptiness. Nothing between you and as far as you can see. Stillness. Freedom. And then you'd look down and you could see, because of like Google Maps, before Google Maps ever existed, you could see where you come from. You could see the whole world, as it were. They're all laid out in front of you. So you could understand things. You could understand where you came from. And where you needed to go the following day. Insight. And I realized that that is what meditation does to you. You climb out from the jungle. The jungle of all of your past and future. All of that stuff which has happened to you yesterday, the day before. This is the jungle. It's all tangled. And all of your fears and anxieties of the future, what are you going to eat this afternoon, where are you going to go tomorrow, what are you going to do when you get back home, that's a jungle. And you climb out of that. All of your thoughts. You know how hard it is to think straight? You think this way, that way, and it all gets tangled up, all your thoughts, so you can't really understand what answer you need to make. But you go up that jungle, and there's no more tangle anymore. You've left the tangle, what the Buddha called the thickets of views. A thicket is like these bushes, you know, really prickly and tight. You just can't put yourself through them. So you leave all of that, all your thoughts, all the past and the future, even your body, climbing the pyramid of meditation. And when you're on the top, see infinity in all directions. Emptiness. If you like, you can look down and see what the world is all about. Yeah, insight. So that's why we meditate. And this is what meditation is all about. Leaving the world so you can understand the world. You get the bird's eye view, the Google Maps view. And that's what the insight is. And that's how you understand things. But some of these insights, they will surprise you. As I said, compassion. Every time you think compassion, you don't really know it, but when you start experiencing it, then you start to understand it. And it's understanding, which means you don't get angry at people for not doing what you want because you don't want anything. People can be whatever they want. You don't control the world. Compassion is not, the door of my heart is open to you. Compassion is, the door of my heart is open to the whole of samsara. No matter what it does. And all the pain, all the difficulties, all the stupid things which people do, there's a purpose for it, believe it or not. It's how we learn. Sometimes say, what's the purpose of sickness? Sickness teaches us how to care. If people were always healthy, there wouldn't be that much caring going on. Sickness also teaches us just about impermanence. Things are always changing. We can't take things for granted. So there's many of these things teach us a lot of stuff. And so, in the end, we become at peace with things. And when we become at peace with things, when we care, instead of trying to change, then the world becomes better. It's amazing how many people try and change the world, and they make it worse. We've been trying to change and heal the world for a long time. It's really getting into a mess now. We should try and care for it instead. Change the priority. But anyway, we get these beautiful insights, but some of these insights really challenge us. They make us see things in a totally different way. And those are the great insights, the ones which make you enlightened. So, what are those insights? For those of you who want to become enlightened, it's the insights into who are you? Who is this person listening to me right now? Or is it a person? Who decided to come here on this retreat? Who is writing down those notes? Who did that, Carol? Was that you? Or did you have no choice? Now this is where we really get to the interesting insights. And I love telling these ones. Because if you really understand them, they will change the whole way you look at this world. That's what the big insights do. The big insight, wow, you know, it totally rocks you, turns you upside down. You see things in a totally different way. Now, okay, which simile shall I use? The old simile of the tadpole and the frog. I love this simile. Once there was a little tadpole, and the little tadpole lived, okay, this time lived in a little lake just outside of Jakarta. Because it's a bit cold for tadpoles in Hong Kong. Do you have tadpoles in Hong Kong? Okay. Well, maybe there's also one in Hong Kong as well. Okay, let's make it sort of easy. Live down here in the pond over here. There's a little tadpole who was born in China Grove. And when it grew up, because this is a very developed country, it went to tadpole school in the pond. And in the school, especially in high school, little tadpole majored in chemistry. So tadpole knew that water was H2O. He studied that in chemistry class. And even because there's many people come on this retreat and teach, the little tadpole even learned some Abhidharma about the nature of water. And so when tadpole graduated from the school in the pond, little tadpole taught other little tadpoles chemistry and about the nature of water. And in fact, tadpole became the expert on water in the China Grove pond. But even though she was professor of hydrology in the pond at China Grove, do you think little tadpole could really understand what water was? How can a fish understand what water is? Because it was born in the water, lived all its life in the water. No more than a tadpole can understand what water is, even though studied it. I was a professor, just like professors of Buddhism sometimes. They studied it, they translated it, they know just nothing about it. But the difference between a tadpole and a fish was one day the tadpole grows legs and arms. It becomes a frog. And when it becomes a frog, little tadpole jumps out of the lake. And that's the strangest experience ever. Sitting on dry land is nothing like being in the water. In fact, the first time it does it, it usually jumps straight back again because it's scared. You understand what I'm talking about now? Nimittas, jhanas, it's really scary. It's nothing like you've ever had before. But little tadpole, now a frog, jumps out again, and soon sits on dry land and realizes, why is this so strange? It is because something which was always there, which it hadn't noticed before, which it could not really understand before, is now gone. That is water. Always been there, but now it's vanished. Now, for the first time, tadpole now become a frog. Now she can know what water is. In the same way, do you really understand what your body is and your five senses? Carol, are you really a girl? Tasvan, are you really Indonesian? I'm sorry, but you're not. But we think we are. But one day, tadpole Carol becomes frog Carol. And she jumps outside of her body into jhanas. That's weird. That's strange. Because something is missing. which has always been there for you ever since you were born. Your body and your five senses. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, vanished. It's absolutely gone. Now you understand what this body is with its five senses. You understand? Sorry, you're not a girl. You're just in a girl's body. Just like you may drive a Toyota, doesn't mean you're a Toyota just because you drive one. So, now you realize you are not this body, because you now know what the body is. But that's only the start. There's also other things start to disappear. Soon, I always say this, in the second jhana, it's just so obvious. There's something more that is missing, which has always been there for you. So much you've misunderstood it. And what missing in the second jhana is your will. It's mostly missing in the first jhana, but second jhana is really obvious. Your will. The thing which decides what to do. The choice. Do you know what that is? Can you really understand it? How can you ever understand what the will is when it's always there for you? No more than a fish can understand water. But when you jump out and land in the second jhana, there's something which is not there anymore. It's gone, it's vanished. Wow. That is really spooky. Now you can understand what this will is, what craving is. What doing is. Now you won't believe me because you can't actually see this. It's just an empty process, nothing to do with you. It's not your friend, it doesn't come from you. You, none of you here decided to come on this retreat. You had no choice. Sorry. Adam Brahm, that's not true. I decided. I even wrote out the form, I made the decision, I discussed it with my wife and my friends, I decided to come here, that's rubbish. But when you get into jhanas, you will soon find out, no, I'm sorry, you had no choice but to come here. The thing which you understand as will is not coming from you. It's all conditioned. And in fact, the reason why you meditate, the reason why you let go, the reason why you will get into jhana, nothing to do with you. Because of me, you have now been brainwashed. I'm sorry, but it's too late now. And don't blame me, I was brainwashed by Ajahn Chah. He was brainwashed by his teacher. It all comes down to the Buddha. He was the first brainwasher. He messes up with your will. You learn how to let go until it totally lets go and your will stops. That is why I keep on telling you, striving will not lead to a jhana, will not lead to enlightenment. It just keeps this will going. Letting go. Open the door of your heart, which is another form of letting go, compassion. Being still. That calms the doer, the will, the craving down until it stops. It's scary to let go of the will because it is your most cherished possession, your will, your free choice. It's the thing which you protect at all costs. But when you let it go, and it feels good, it's safe, you realize it wasn't you anyway. Now you can let go totally. And have a peaceful time. You can sit down, bye-bye Will, and just get into nice deep meditations. Great insights. You all know the Buddha kept on saying, anatta, there is no me, no mine, not a self. So who the hell is doing all of this? Who's making all these choices? The Buddha said, no one. But there's choice there. Condition, cause and effect, rolling. I teach like this because this is how I was conditioned. And I tell bad jokes. and it's not my fault. Don't blame me for any bad joke. Okay, the latest bad joke. I told this to some kids last Friday night. The latest very bad joke. Three prisoners escaped from jail. And the police saw them and chased them. And it was night time, so they ran into a park and they climbed a tree each to hide from the police. And it was very dark, but the police had flashlights. So they were looking for the prisoners, the escaped convicts, and they shone the flashlight into the tree. They saw a dark shape up in the tree. They say, "What's that? What's that?" And the prisoner, thinking very quickly, went, "Meow, meow." And the police said, "Oh, it's only a cat, it's a cat." It's really the convict who's being clever. Went to the next tree, shone the flashlight up there, and saw another dark shape. "What's that?" "Tweet, tweet, tweet, tweet." Like, I can't do bird sounds, okay. "Tweet, tweet." "Oh, it's only a bird." So they went to the next tree, the third tree. And the third criminal was up there, hiding in a tree. And he thought, "Wow, this is how to escape from the police." So when they shone a light there, when it hit the prisoner, it said, "What's the black shape up there? What's that?" And he went, "Moo, moo." That's a terrible joke, but don't blame me. Because my father told terrible jokes like that. So just condition, that's what it was. And even Ajahn Chah told jokes as well. Sometimes it's so hilarious. So anyway, that's conditioning. So don't blame me. I take no responsibility because it's not my will. So this is where you get insights from. And these are not what you can think. It doesn't make sense thinking about it no more than a tadpole can think about water. It makes sense. But one day, you grow legs. You're growing legs now. You jump outside the water into the jhanas. Now you get insights. Which means when you come back again, you're never the same. People do ask, and I haven't been totally honest with you. I should be, so I'm going to correct it now. When I said that getting into jhanas, you're perfectly safe. And it's true, you can't be physically harmed. You won't die or get sick or get possessed. But there is one danger for getting into jhanas. And that danger is you may end up losing your hair. If you get into jhanas, you want to become a monk or not? So that's the only danger. So you're warned. But it's worth it. It's a nice thing to do. Okay, so that's a little talk on insight. So now, sit down, do nothing. Now's the most important time. Whatever is in front of you, that is the most important. And be kind. Don't try and change things. Let go. Be peaceful. Your mind gets so peaceful, so still. All these jhanas happen by themselves. You're calming down your will. When the will stops, body vanishes, you enter a jhana. Such an easy thing to do. Saying from the Visuddhimagga, the path is, but no traveler on it is seen. You can't do the path. You vanish, let go, and then the path is as easy as anything. If you're traveling the path, you're doing it, if you're meditating, you'll never get anywhere. You have to vanish, disappear. Poof. When there's no traveler, the path is easy. Da da da, da 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 da. Okay. So, that's the end of the talk. Three sadhus. Sadhu. 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 Okay, have a wonderful morning. Very good. Thank you, Teddy Bear. The end of Thursday morning comedy.